This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with ethics professor, attorney Ellen Yaroshevsky, and get some insight on the suspension of Rudy Giuliani from the practice of law in this country. Next, we speak with attorney Margaret Ratner Kunstler on the January 6th insurrection. We'll learn who organized it, who paid for it, and what are their future plans.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
2 weeks ago, former President Donald Trump's attorney Rudy Giuliani's license to practice law was suspended. The disciplinary committee of the New York City Appellate Division Court, where Giuliani had been licensed to practice law, ruled that he, quote, communicated demonstrably false and misleading statements to courts, lawmakers, and the public at large in his capacity as a lawyer for Trump and the Trump campaign in connection with Trump's failed effort at re-election in 2020. In addition, on January 6th, the committee took notice of Giuliani's urging the crowd in Washington, D.C. to make law by, quote, trial by combat. The disciplinary committee found that Giuliani's conduct, quote, immediately threatened the public interest and warranted interim suspension from the practice of law. Giuliani became the first attorney to experience professional consequences for perpetuating lies about fraud in the 2020 election. He had been the main prosecutor in the Southern District of New York before becoming the city's mayor. After 9/11, he was widely viewed as a hero and denominated America's mayor. He went on to practice law representing a number of corporations and became very rich before becoming Trump's attorney. We speak today with professor and attorney Ellen Yaroshevsky. She is one of the signatories to one of the complaints against Giuliani. Professor Yaroshevsky is the Howard Lichtenstein Professor of Legal Ethics at Hofstra Law School and the director of the Monroe Friedman Institute for the Study of Legal Ethics. Ellen Yaroshevsky, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. I'm pleased to be here.
Ellen, how did you become a law professor specializing in ethics?
Well, that was unintended and quite fortunate. I was a criminal defense lawyer and a civil rights lawyer working at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, and recruited by Barry Scheck, who later started the Innocence Project, to work at Cardozo in a criminal defense clinic, which I did for a while. And then we got money from a benefactor to start an ethics center to teach ethics in a very practice-based way, which I started doing in 1994. And the rest is history. We created an ethics center. I taught a lot of ethics courses. I then became involved in many different ethics committees over the years, giving advice to lawyers and doing expert work. And then 5 years ago, I was recruited to go to Hofstra, which had Monroe Friedman as a professor for many years. He was the left wing, if you will, of the ethics bar around the country. And after he passed away, they created an institute in his name, and I was very fortunate to be hired there. And I run a social justice fellows program there, as well as continue to do ethics work.
What did Rudolph Giuliani do to merit interim suspension from the practice of law?
He did quite a few things that had been unheard of in the past, if you will. There are so many false statements that he made, false statements in court, and then, as many people know, a myriad of false statements outside of court about the elections, claims like dead people were voting, including Joe Frazier, who had died many years before. He was a famous boxer, claiming that he, along with other dead people, had voted, claimed that there were hundreds of thousands of extra mail-in ballots that had been counted, that shouldn't have been counted, that tens of thousands of underage people voted in Georgia. Those are among the claims that he made that the court discussed in their really unprecedented suspension. These things just don't happen.
How many lawsuits were filed and how many were thrown out?
You mean election law lawsuits
by
the Trump organizations? Well,
yes.
He is just one of the many lawyers who filed election law claims on behalf of the Trump organization. on behalf of Trump, and then there were other lawsuits filed as well. Depends how you count them. There are 62 lawsuits that were filed. All of them were thrown out with the exception of one little minor Pennsylvania case that I'll talk about in a minute. But there, all told, there are 86 lawsuits that were filed that challenged the elections. And among the things they said, they claimed that there was voter fraud. They claimed that the vote counting was illegal. They claimed the voter certification processes were illegal. They claimed lots of claims about the election process itself. You may remember that they keep saying publicly that there was election fraud. They kept using the term fraud, but only in one case, in Giuliani's case, did they actually use fraud. Of course, Giuliani claimed to a Pennsylvania judge that the case was about fraud, which it wasn't at all, and the judge finally called him on it, and he had to back off. That was one of the allegations in this disciplinary complaint against him, that he went to a judge and he lied to a judge. He said that the court, that there was an allegation of fraud, and there clearly was not. So with all these cases that were brought, they were thrown out by Trump-appointed judges, by all kinds of judges, both in local courts, state courts, federal courts, and ultimately by the Supreme Court, with the exception of one minor case about Wisconsin counting that didn't really make a huge difference. But all of these cases were thrown out. It was pretty remarkable, and they were all in swing states. So they went after Pennsylvania, Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Texas, and Wisconsin. And the courts were scathing in their complaints about these various cases, calling them frivolous, calling them without merit. I mean, you may remember the names Sidney Powell and Lynn Wood. Sidney Powell is the lawyer who filed a number of cases on behalf of Trump in the election, trying to throw it out, claiming that the algorithms had been made up. This is Dominion. That may be a familiar name to people. She claimed that Dominion, the company that had engaged in some of the voting algorithms, had made up the algorithms. There's absolutely no evidence whatsoever to support that. That's the subject of a lawsuit now. Dominion is suing her, and they're suing Giuliani for billions of dollars. There's another case. They just go on and on, Michael. There's a case they call Sharpiegate, where in Arizona, one of the claims was, well, the voters use Sharpies, and they're not allowed to use Sharpies. There was no basis whatsoever saying you couldn't use Sharpies, and in fact, Sharpies were better than using pencils. So that was yet another example of the kinds of cases that they filed, and each of these cases were thrown out of court. The only one that I said succeeded was one in Pennsylvania. It was about the date that for which voters could vote without ID. Did they need ID or not? Ultimately, they won. They won in the lower court, and then the Pennsylvania Supreme Court threw it out. So it was a minor victory for a short period of time. So it's just remarkable to see all of these cases filed by people on behalf of Trump, all of these lawyers, and the cases get thrown out of court. Giuliani is one of the people who was subject to discipline, which is to say disciplinary complaints filed against him. Sidney Powell is another one. There's disciplinary complaints filed against her. Lynn Wood's another. I think that these are probably familiar names to your listenership because they're all over the news. Sidney Powell is the one who claimed the Kraken are coming to get you. The Kraken will come, and people really didn't know what that was unless they'd watched Game of Thrones. But that's the level at which these cases had been litigated. I mean, ultimately, the campaign apparently decided Sidney Powell was too much of a liability. So they got rid of her. She, of course, went off on her own and filed complaints, constantly challenging the election itself. And she's been, is going to be sanctioned by a court. Lynn Wood may be sanctioned by a court. I mean, they did so many untoward things that lawyers just should not do, like they just slapped up new complaints and put in plaintiffs who hadn't even agreed to be part of the cases. Or they typed the wrong jurisdiction. They put in a county in one of the cases that didn't even exist. So they were completely sloppy, as well as filing claims that had absolutely no merit and they've all been struck down by courts.
We're speaking with Professor Ellen Yaroshevsky, who's an expert on ethics. Ellen, what rules apply regarding an attorney's public statements and statements in court with respect to the truth?
Well, look, lawyers, I know it sounds odd to say lawyers aren't supposed to lie because there are all these jokes about what happens if, you know, when a lawyer opens their mouth, right? Lawyers are liars. But we actually have very significant rules because we govern ourselves as lawyers, right? We have a process by which we say lawyers have to obey a certain set of rules of the profession. If they don't, they can be disciplined. And among those rules are you can't make false or misleading statements to a court. You certainly can't do that. It's called the tribunal. And if you do that, you can be subject to discipline. That's one of the complaints against Giuliani. You also can't make false statements or misleading statements to third people. Third persons is what the rule says. You can't engage in deceit or dishonesty. And with respect to statements to the public, right, in connection with a lawsuit, if you're making going out to the public and making false statements about that lawsuit, a lawyer can be disciplined, and that's what they suspended Giuliani on here, for making those false statements in connection with his lawsuit. So there's a rule about trial publicity that says lawyers who are in a trial or in a matter, as we call it in law, which is to say a case, they can only make certain statements about the case itself, because the idea is you don't want to unfairly prejudice the people who are going to be deciding your case. So we have a rule on trial publicity. But if a lawyer is not involved, let's say you're just a commentator on a radio show or a commentator on a TV show, but you're not involved in a particular case, you have a First Amendment right to say what you want, true or false. Right, and so lawyers don't get sanctioned generally for doing that, and they shouldn't be sanctioned for doing that because they have First Amendment rights. But when it comes to a case itself, and like Giuliani, he's going into court and saying the election was a fraud. First he says it's a fraud, and then he says, no, it's not. The court called him on that, and the court said, you're making a false statement to the court. And then he went outside the court. And if you remember, one of the things he did, they thought they were holding a press conference at a place called the Four Seasons. And somehow by mistake, they booked this place called the Four Seasons Total Landscaping Club, which was between a sex shop and a crematorium. And he holds his press conference where he starts talking about all kinds of fraud and voters not voting, dead people voting. And so those false claims were made in connection with his fraud claim. So that lawyer, any lawyer who does that, is subject to discipline because you're basically violating the promise that you make to the public when you become a lawyer. Right? You take the bar, you're brought before a committee on character, and you swear to uphold the Constitution and to abide by the rules of the profession. And one of the things we expect is that you don't engage in this kind of lying and making false statements to courts and to the public when you're engaged in representation of a client.
Were disciplinary charges filed against Giuliani, and what are they?
Well, there are lots of people who file disciplinary complaints against Giuliani. Anybody can file a complaint against a lawyer. Your listenership probably doesn't know that, right? And so we don't, and they're usually private. We don't really find out about them unless they get publicized. So what we know now is like more than 100 complaints were filed against Giuliani by various people. I was part of one complaint filed by and organized by the former head of the New York State Bar Association, Michael Miller, a very prestigious lawyer in New York, who was quite upset about Giuliani's conduct. I mean, many lawyers, not just upset, but really embarrassed, and keep asking, how can it be that we allow a lawyer, particularly a prominent lawyer like Giuliani? I mean, after all, he'd been the mayor. He'd been the head of the Southern District of New York. He'd been at the Department of Justice. How can it be that a lawyer is not sanctioned for engaging in this kind of contumacious conduct, if you will? It's just outrageous. And so we filed a lengthy complaint. It was around the same time as another group, the Lawyers Defending American Democracy, filed a complaint. There's a terrific lawyer named Dennis Aftergut, who helped form that organization. It's based in San Francisco. And they got more than 7,500 signatures on their complaint. And they had 14 former federal judges. They had Department of Justice people. I mean, the profession is very upset about Giuliani's conduct. And so they filed a complaint. I recently learned that several other lawyers had filed complaints as well. And then in May, we recently found out that the governor and the attorney general of states also filed complaints against Giuliani. So all these complaints were filed. Most of them were filed, and I can cite the rules, but I don't think it really matters. But the rule about not making a false statement to a court, that was one complaint. Making false, dishonest, deceitful comments to others, that was another one. Overall, undermining the administration of justice. Those are the basic complaints against him. They're all based upon making allegations that turn out not to be true. And we don't really, you know, this is really unheard of. I mean, I don't think, I certainly didn't, and none of my colleagues really expected that New York was going to take action, particularly not suspending him until there's a hearing. I mean, that's unheard of, and it's pretty extreme, but his conduct is really extreme.
Why don't more lawyers file disciplinary charges, and how common is it?
Well, excellent question, Michael. I mean, there's lots of look, lawyers don't like to file charges against other lawyers. Let's start there, right? People think of it as, even though we're supposed to be upholding the profession, it seems like you're being a snitch against other lawyers. And so lawyers don't like doing that. So that's to begin with. But it also depends on the field. You know, in the criminal sphere, if you're a criminal defense lawyer and you believe a prosecutor has engaged in misconduct, you're just not going to file charges. The reason being that prosecutor is going to hold it against your next client. And so you just generally don't do that. There's a group of people now looking at filing disciplinary complaints against prosecutors who are hiding evidence, but that's not done very frequently. Overall, the reason is that people just don't expect a whole lot out of the disciplinary process. I mean, historically, people who have political power, they're never disciplinary complaints that are upheld, that are sustained, where there are hearings against such people. The disciplinary process has generally been used against solo and small firm practitioners who either don't return telephone calls for a long period of time, don't really deal with their clients' cases in the way clients would like, or take clients' money. And that's really what the disciplinary system has been used for. And so now, particularly in the Trump era, when many people, including me and some of my colleagues, have looked to file complaints against Giuliani, against William Barr, against other government lawyers or lawyers in the public eye, other colleagues say, oh, this is just political. You shouldn't be using the disciplinary process in a political way. But it's not political. It's what it's supposed to be for, right? That if it's my belief that if lawyers are violating fundamental principles of being lawyers, that the profession has to take responsibility, and that we need to do that. But there are very few lawyers who actually engage in that. Maybe we'll see more of them doing so now, because in this relatively unprecedented case, the First Department in New York took this seriously. So, you know, it's very courageous on their part. You know, it's probably a once-in-a-decade or maybe a once-in-a-century event. I would say let's hope we don't see too many lawyers behaving like Rudy Giuliani. You know, it's particularly untoward. I mean, things, you know, just from his appearance with his shoe polish dripping from his cheek while he's talking, to some of his commentary, it just seems so beyond the pale that hopefully that we won't see too many lawyers doing this.
Giuliani's license was suspended, but not yet revoked. What's the future of procedure with him?
Well, what happened here was the court said, because there's no, all the evidence shows that he engaged in these fraudulent, in these statements. He falsely said there was fraud. Yes, he made all these claims about voters who shouldn't have voted. They were all false. They were uncontroverted. And they said because those were uncontroverted, and because he's such a danger to the public, that they're going to suspend him on an interim basis until there is a hearing and he's entitled to a full hearing. I mean, lawyers are entitled to due process. Typically what happens is if there's a disciplinary complaint and the committee of the bar looks at it and says, yes, there's merit, they then hold a hearing. They hold a hearing, and at that hearing, they make a determination of whether they find that you've done this or not, and then they decide upon a sanction. It is very rare, like here, where they say, until we have a hearing, we're going to suspend you. And that's what they did here because they thought he was such a danger, and he didn't come forward with any evidence showing that there was an issue as to whether or not he did these things. I mean, one of the interesting things about the opinion, and the court went to great pains to point this out, is that Giuliani kept saying in there, well, you know, we have a confidential informant who will say that there was that these claims are really true, that there was a voter fraud, or that there's a blogger who said that. They made all these claims, but they didn't put in any proof of it. And typically what you have to do as a lawyer in these complaints, if you're answering a complaint, you have to attach what's called an affidavit, which is a signed statement from the person who says, yup, I know that there's voter fraud, and here's what I saw, or here's what I did. They didn't attach any affidavits. The courts noted that. They said he's making all these claims without any proof whatsoever. His claim that he has some confidential informant, they basically said, they don't use the word absurd, but they make it appear as if it's absurd, because they said he's not a government lawyer, and it's only the government that can use confidential informants, not a private lawyer, so basically we don't know what he's talking about. And they went to great pains to say, you know, if he has some proof of this, he should have put this in here. So maybe at a hearing, which will occur if he wants to have one, he can come forward and say, look, I didn't know that these statements were false because I relied on this blogger, or I didn't know these statements were false because this person told me so. It appears that that's going to be his defense at a hearing. But so the process now, he has 20 days, sorry, from the time of his suspension to file for a hearing. It looks like he's doing that. At the hearing, they will schedule a hearing. The prosecutors, if you will, they're not really prosecutors here. They're disciplinary counsel. They will put forward their evidence showing that he violated all these rules, and then he gets to testify, and he gets to put on whatever witnesses he would like to demonstrate his contention, which is, I didn't know that these were false. It's hard to believe that he's going to be able to sustain that, because there's no proof whatsoever of anything that he said. Most of those claims have been debunked in every single court that have considered them, so he's going to be hard-pressed to prove it, but I think that's what he's going to claim, that he just didn't know that it was false. So it looks like he's going to have a hearing. I mean, the other option is he can just decide that, you know, he doesn't really want to be a lawyer anymore, and he could resign. Or he could go to the disciplinary committee itself and try to negotiate a suspension instead of a disbarment. But where we are now is it looks like there will be a hearing. It's a hearing in private. It's not open to the public, and we shall see what happens.
We've been talking with ethics professor Ellen Yaroshevsky. Ellen, we're coming to the end of our allotted time here, but before we have to let you go, let me ask you this. Let's bring your attention to Trump himself. What do you expect will happen to him? Do you think he or his business or his business associates will be prosecuted? And by whom and when and for what?
Okay. The Manhattan District Attorney has filed very narrow charges against the Trump Organization, not against Donald Trump. They may amend those, and they claim that there's an ongoing investigation. It appears as if what they're trying to do is to get some people to cooperate with them to offer testimony. And if they can get cooperators who will be reliable in court, they could file charges against Trump, but it does not look like they're planning on doing that. It's unfortunate. I think part of the problem is they're very cautious, and they don't want to file charges if they think that there's some chance that they're not going to win. And so they're quite risk-averse about doing this. Obviously, it will be a very big deal if there are charges filed against him. We're looking to Georgia. It will be really interesting to see what happens in Georgia, because that would be a state where charges could be sustained for the conduct during the course of the election, particularly with respect to the encouraging the insurrection on January 6th. But once again, the people, the prosecutors who are looking at these charges are very cautious, and it's unclear, I think, whether or not they will go forward. There are many people who believe that they should, that it's really important for the state of democracy in this country to ensure that people are held accountable for their conduct. But it looks like the U.S. Attorney Merrick Garland is backing off, and many people are criticizing him. It looks like the Manhattan DA is moving very cautiously, and thus far we haven't heard anything from Georgia. So I wouldn't hold my breath.
Ellen, before we say goodbye, do you have any final thoughts?
Well, you know, I'm just very encouraged, and I hope people pay attention to the fact that we need to hold lawyers to account. If they're going to behave in this fashion, that, you know, we need to ensure that people like this don't get to continue this kind of conduct. So I appreciate you holding a show on this, Michael. I think it is really important.
How can listeners follow this story and follow your work, Ellen?
I don't have a blog, so you can use my name for when I'm quoted. But you can follow this in the press. Forbes actually just published an excellent story about the complaints against Giuliani and other lawyers. So if people are interested, you could look at that. You could also look at the LDAD, the Lawyers Defending American Democracy. They have an excellent website where they're cataloging all the complaints that are being made and the extent to which they're being sustained against lawyers.
Ellen Yaroshevsky, keep up the good work. It's really been a pleasure talking with you on Law and Disorder. You take it easy.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's been my pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
There have been three previous radicalizations in the USA, one before the First World War 100 years ago, the second occurred during the 1930s, and the third during the 1960s. We are now in the midst of a fourth radicalization. We saw it last year when 20 million people, black-led, took to the streets protesting police murder. At the same time we have a radicalization of the left, we also have one on the right. The one on the right has been building for 40 years. A right-wing racist nationalist demagogue, Donald Trump, got 74 million votes in the last election. People and organizations supporting Trump and egged on by him ransacked the Capitol on January 6th. The military was an active participant by refusing calls to intervene to stop the invasion of the building, Barry Shepard wrote in Greenleaf Weekly. They stood by for some 4 hours. Eventually, it was the Washington, D.C. police who finally ended it. Caroline Orr, writing in Byline Times, wrote that the Capitol riot was not a spontaneous outburst of violence, but rather a carefully orchestrated, well-funded attempt to violently overthrow the election and bring an end to democracy in America. Further, she wrote that there is a close alliance between violent extremists and mainstream factions of the Republican Party, including wealthy donors and elected officials. The Republicans in Congress succeeded in blocking a proposal to convene a bipartisan committee to investigate the ransacking. For his part, Biden has avoided talking about it, evidently in an attempt to assure his allies in Europe that America is still a democracy. Who did it? What did they hope to accomplish? And what has been done by way of investigating and criminal prosecution? We speak today with longtime human rights attorney Margaret Ratner Kunstler. She worked at the Center for Constitutional Rights and is the editor of the recent book, In Defense of Julian Assange. Attorney Margaret Ratner Kunstler, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
Margaret, is there a close alliance between violent extremists and mainstream factions of the Republican Party, including wealthy donors and elected officials?
You know, Michael, that's an interesting question because I don't think there are mainstreamers anymore with any power in the Republican Party. I think it has become a totally radical organization that is willing to achieve whatever it can by any means necessary. And that was clear from what happened on January 6th. And also, it's clear from the fact that 138 Republican lawmakers were committed to rejecting the certification. I mean, there is no sensible part of the Republican Party that is in any position of power. And then you have specific people, members of the party, like Andy Biggs, Arizona, Paul Gosar. They're totally involved with the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. And then you have Marjorie Taylor Smith Greene, who's the QAnon, and then Matt Gaetz, who's with the Proud Boys. I mean, these are Lauren Bobbitt is with three percenters. It is a totally radicalized group with contacts with the militia and members of Congress.
What did they and what do they want to accomplish?
Well, they wanted Trump to remain as the president of the United States. I think that they were very satisfied with what they accomplished through Trump in his first term, and they had great plans to continue what they wanted to achieve in the second term, and they were willing to do whatever they could to achieve that. And they, you know, the planning that went into it was tremendous, and the funding that went into it was tremendous. It was absolutely well funded. The problem is that COVID came up in the middle of Trump's campaign. And Trump liked to do his campaign with mass groups that he talked to. But every time he did that, there was problems because people became ill. So he had to be careful about having these mass groups. And as part of this COVID way of dealing with things is that they determined that they would make the COVID protections a loss of liberty. So wearing a mask was a loss of liberty, not being able to associate, all of these things that were put into effect, whatever the scientists had to say about the best things to do, were rejected by them. And they had a movement called End the Lockdown. And that movement was quite effective for a while, but then it stopped being effective enough and people were concerned that Trump might not win. So then everything else that they did was based on the election, directly on the election. And they started immediately planning, you know, 10 ways to ensure that Trump would be successful. They planned legal actions. They planned rallies. They planned many, many things. And the culmination of these things was the January 6th event.
Attorney Margaret Ratner Kunstler, which groups organized the January 6th ransacking of the Capitol? Who were their leaders? What did they hope to accomplish?
Well, the first thing they had to accomplish was getting thousands of people there. There are really two issues in terms of the January 6th event, the January 6th insurrection. The first task was to get people there. And the second task was to figure out what to say and how to handle the event. And that kept changing because Trump's chances kept changing, and what he was trying to do to keep the possibility of his winning in power. So the program of the event really did not become fixed until January 5th. And even then, as I'll tell you later, there were questions about what they were going to do. But there were two organizations that were in charge of getting out the crowd, and that was Women for America First and Stop This Deal. Now, Stop This Deal was headed by Ali Alexander, who from September on was gathering names and figuring out how to organize people and get people together to get to demonstrations. He was working with other groups that were doing exactly the same thing. They were right-wing Republican policy groups like the Council for National Policy, the Save America PAC, America First Policies. All of these groups were getting out as much as they could to their followers to get on a bus and get to Washington on the 6th to be there for the rally. So those were the major group that was responsible for getting the people out there was the Women's March. The Women's March was the best funded of all of these groups, and they started out with Facebook account with 365,000 people. So they were starting out with a base from which to go. This was premised on work that they had done to end opposing the COVID-19 work that was being done to prevent people from getting the disease. But so they gathered a lot of those names, and all of these organizations switched from COVID work to Stop the Steel War. And that was done probably in September, October, when they were getting nervous about whether Trump was going to win the election. So the Women's March for Women's March for Trump was run by Women for America First. They had it started 6 weeks before January 6th. They had a bus full of people that stopped at 30 places across the U.S. And they stopped at a lot of churches. They stopped at any place that would welcome them to talk. They stopped and talked, and that's really how they got the most number of people to attend the January 6th event. The other part of it was the Stop the Steal movement, which had been, as I said, started by Ali Alexander in September, and he had tremendous political contacts both with the militia, the Republican right, and the reactionary press. So he had all of those contacts, and he put out calls, and he used the Facebook, did the other half of the job of bringing people out to the event. So you had Stop the Steal and Women's March for Trump. Those two groups were the groups that were getting people to the insurrection.
Margaret, how would you characterize the class makeup of these groups? Working class, middle class, lower middle class?
No, these groups were, the forming groups were extremely wealthy. And this wasn't, this was a top-down movement. And it depended on money, it depended on control of media, it depended on many things. And this was not an event that depended on grassroots support. The grassroots support was manufactured by very wealthy, very organized people. So when you say who were the attendees to this event, well, they probably were lower middle class, I would assume, but they were people who were easy to talk into believing in the fantasies that these people were putting out, and they worked very hard putting them out. That if Trump didn't win, there would be no liberty. People would wear masks forever. you know, with all of their, there would be hundreds of abortions, the babies would be destroyed. I mean, that they went on all of these insane positions and really got pretty far with them. But it wasn't from the ground up. It was from the top down.
There were various police intelligence services monitoring the various groups from the start through the action. Which groups? Which intelligence agencies?
Well, you know, the FBI had some indication of what was happening, but they were not particularly interested in it, because what Trump had put forth, and he actually, you know, was quite forceful at it, was that his people, the Proud Boys, were to be protected, not to be investigated. And so there was very little investigation of these groups. These groups were used to give the FBI information about Antifa, about Black Lives Matter. They were not being investigated at all.
Did the intelligence services give any prior warning? What did they know, and when did they know it?
There was some indication that there were some messages that were going out the night before and three nights before the event, saying that expect violence. The fact that they didn't prepare for violence, I don't know where they were, if they had ever gotten to Facebook or anything else. Violence was threatened for 4 months, and it kept getting more and more desperate as people were more and more fearful. And then once Trump lost, well, then the world was coming to an end for these people, and they wanted to put him in illegally. That was the only thing they could do. So the fact that there wasn't better preparation is very suspicious, you know, and I think it's due to the fact that the people in the administration said, let's not pay attention to this. These are our guys.
How would you characterize the role of Donald Trump?
Donald Trump was the leader in chief. I mean, there's no question. He was in charge, and his campaign took over from Stop the Steal, which was going to the Stop the Steal and the women's Women for Trump were originally in charge of the actual event on the 6th. But at the last minute, the Trump machine, his friends, his family, his close supporters took over what was going to happen at the event. So they did it with the people who were the Stop the Steal people. They did it with Roger Stone, with Ali Alexander, with Stuart Rhodes from the Oath Keepers. And also Alex Jones was very important in this, because he was their media guy. And then you had Flynn and Bannon. But it was definitely taken over from Stop the Steal and the Women's March. And some people say that the reason that it was taken over is because they probably had ways to prevent the chaos, and ways, for example, not having the march to the Capitol in the way that they had it, and not saying, and Trump not announcing that he was going to be there with them, and failing to announce that Pence was not going to go along with it. Because when these people thought that there was a possibility that Pence was going to go along with it, so, well, let's march, let's force people to go along with it. It was an insane activity. You know, Trump had people calling into Congress trying to make sure that he had the ten objections that would prevent the vote from happening. And that was that crazy call where he tried to reach Tommy Tuberville. He was depending on Tuberville to give three more states so that he could stop the certification. It was, you know, quite wild. I think that it was planned to be that way, because that's what Trump wanted to happen. I mean, he wasn't alone in this. I think that Roger Stone and Flynn and the Proud Boys and Stuart Rhodes and the Oath Keepers and the Three Percenters were wanted to go along with that, and were perhaps more interested in that than a peaceful demonstration. And it could have been a peaceful demonstration, but there was a decision not to have it be peaceful. And there were things done to make it chaotic.
What has the investigation shown, and How many and who have been indicted and for what? And does this include the leaders of the Proud Boys, the Three Percenters, and QAnon?
Well, it actually doesn't really include the leaders. There are, well, they're not exactly leaders, but they are major participants in these organizations. Let me just find my list of indictments. 7 conspiracy indictments. One of the Oath Keepers, 5 of the Proud Boys, and 1 for Three Percenters, 5 for the Proud Boys, 1 for the Three Percenters, and 1 for the Oath Keepers. The Oath Keeper one is quite long. And the Oath Keepers were in this grouping really in charge of communications among these groups, which was very important because, you know, this was an armed, planned assault that was happening that could have been held back but was encouraged. Now, the Oath Keeper, the main Oath Keeper leader, Stuart Rhodes, was not there. And if you notice, all of those people whose names I mentioned who were key organizers of this did not go on the march. Now, they didn't even know that Trump was not going to go on the march, because that was Trump's decision at the last minute because he didn't want anybody to know what he was doing. So, in fact, the second group of people, Roger Stone didn't even go to the 6th because he knew what was happening and he didn't want to get into any trouble. But the others, Ali Alexander and Alex Jones, were waiting in a position for Trump's car to leave the Capitol and head down, leave the ellipse, and then go down to the Capitol. But that didn't happen. So they were kind of, well, they didn't know what to do because they were told that they should lead the crowd to the Capitol, but they really didn't want to do it without Trump being there because Trump, they thought, would provide them some protection. Anyway, so Trump didn't show up, and so the groups formed, and the first group left in the middle of Trump's speech, which was planned to start the invasion of the Capitol. And the invasion, the actual invasion occurred before the event at the ellipse was over, and the march down of the people followed that. And majority of the people got there. They had already broken through the barriers and even broken through some of the windows.
Margaret, what have the leaders of the Republican Party done about the insurrection? Are they trying to play it down?
Absolutely. They're doing everything they can to prevent any investigation of what happened and how it happened. They have voted against every possible form of congressional investigation. I think there were 3 different forms that were put up by the Democrats, and they voted each one of them down. They don't want this to become an issue, and you can understand why. And what they are doing is they're characterizing it as it's just another demonstration, and not, it wasn't so violent, it wasn't so bad. These were people on vacation. These were tourists. It was denying the reality of it, because when they deny the reality of something, they think that they can be effective and successful. But what they're doing, I think what is happening here is something really terrible, and they're normalizing this kind of violence. You know, playing it down. People know what happened, but the fact that they're playing it down makes it possible that this kind of violence is acceptable. And that's a really dangerous happening.
What have the Democratic Party leadership done?
Well, the Democratic Party leadership has tried 3 or 4 times to start investigations of what was happening, what were the causes, what were the events immediately preceding, and they've been totally unsuccessful at that. They do have some committees that are investigating it, but they've been, you know, they haven't come out with anything. And I wonder why this is not being publicized. I think that the true story here is a very dangerous story. And people are saying, well, do we want this story out? Do we want to show that people were really going to overturn a valid election in the U.S.? Is that something we want out there, that that there were these militias and crazy people and Trump trying to actually overturn an election? And then you say, well, maybe you got to think twice about putting that out, because it becomes a national security issue. Now, I mean, you and I think that that saying it's a national security issue is, you know, a phony excuse. But I suspect that that's why it's not being pushed as hard as it should be pushed, and why we don't hear about the leadership and the planning, things like that. But, you know, we do have these indictments. And these indictments, whereas they don't go, you know, very high, do show that there was planning, you know, and do show that there were armed caches. And do show that they were thinking about gassing elected representatives. I mean, all of these things are included in the indictments. And I think that if and when this goes to trial, it will break through.
Attorney Margaret Ratner Kunstler, this has been really enlightening. Unfortunately, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time. But I want to ask you this. Is there a current ongoing threat from these people? QAnon wants a military coup. Is this currently in the cards? Does the January 6th events show that Trump can resort to this again if the right conditions ripen and he has support, especially from the military, and they believe that they can succeed? I mean, what do you think? What are your final thoughts?
Well, I think that ultimately, you know, at the right moment in history and the right number of people, you can be successful with a coup. I mean, there's no question. But I don't think that they even though they're threatening to have a coup in August, that's the story that they're passing around, it can't happen, because, in fact, too many of their militants are being held in preventive detention in Washington, D.C. And if people who look at what is happening and the fact that these people are in jail and about to be tried have a second thought about whether they want to risk putting themselves into that situation. So I think that's a damper on any immediate activity. But, you know, there are these groups, and the Republican Party has moved so far to the right that we are in danger of a coup, not at this moment and not perhaps this year, but it's something that we all should be constantly aware of and try to work against the rise of fascism in this country.
With that sobering thought, Margaret, we're going to have to say goodbye. Thank you so much for your good work in preparing this presentation. We hope to have you on again. We'll keep in touch with you. Thank you again.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.